Hello and welcome to episode 13 of The Entrepreneur Experiment. I am Gary Fox. The Entrepreneur Experiment is all about finding the most interesting entrepreneurs and hearing their stories so you can learn the lessons to start your own business. This week we have a marathon interview for you with the CEO of BuyMe, Devin Hughes. You're going to need a coffee, you're going to need a paper and pen because there's a massive amount of lessons from this. I've just finished editing and listening back to the episode, and there's a huge amount of value in it. I had to stop it a number of times and just scribble down some notes. Devin runs BuyMe, which is one of the biggest Irish startups in the on-demand space. I'll let him tell his own story, but I hope you enjoy this episode. It's a long one, but if you stick right to the end, there's some nuggets right at the end which are worth listening to just for those alone. If you'd like to win a copy of the book Devin recommends, simply share this episode on social media and make sure to tag me. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to this week's episode of The Entrepreneur Experiment. This week, a very special guest is Devin Hughes from BuyMe. So Devin, welcome.
Thank you very much, Gary. Thank you for having me. So my name is Devin Hughes, and I am the CEO and co-founder of BuyMe. So essentially what BuyMe is we are a on-demand grocery delivery platform, but we are retailer agnostic. So what that means is that we let users order grocery and household items from large retailers like Tesco and Lidl. And they can have those items delivered store to door in as little as an hour by a personal shopper.
Okay. Very good.
Yeah. In a nutshell.
Very succinct. I suspect that's not the first time you've done that today even.
No.
Yeah. Actually, that's where we'll start. You're fresh off a win. So tell us about that.
Thank you very much. Yeah. We got the prize for best established Ireland's best young entrepreneur 2019 on Monday.
Congratulations.
For Dublin City. Yeah, we were absolutely thrilled. We were really over the moon with it, actually. It was really good timing. Mm. Got lots of exciting stuff going on in the background. So, getting a little award under our belt was well placed. And it's our first.
How long are you in business, actually? When you say established business, how long are you guys in operation?
This is the funny part. So, if you were to ask me, I'd say we're still very much a startup. Mm. But we're 3 years in the market now. Which is a little bit bizarre when I think about it.
In startup terms, yeah. That's like 30.
Yeah, exactly. startup years. It is really quite strange to think that actually we've been going since February 2016.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a nice little segue onto the first stage of the entrepreneur experiment. So one second. The first stage is idea generation. So Where did the idea for BuyMe come from?
So it was an interesting one, right? So my background is not grocery, not FMCG or anything like that. I used to work in the energy markets. So I used to help large retailers, manufacturers, pharmaceuticals to manage and trade gas and electricity to save them money. There's big energy spenders. So I would have specialized in essentially commodity management, distribution, and efficiency. And that was kind of where I spent most of my years. BuyMe is my fifth startup.
Okay.
But I'd spent most of my time, dabbling in the energy markets and a little bit of tech. But that's where I was kind of primarily sitting. And then in 2014, I was getting the itch to do something again by myself. And I wanted to get out of energy. It was too heavily regulated. And you need massive capex to do anything in that space. And I wanted to get into tech because, well, for a couple of reasons. One, I figured Ireland was probably going to become quite a significant tech hub for Europe. The money was going to be way better if you were in tech. So it would be better to be in there as early in your career as possible. So I was quite pragmatic in that point of view. But then from an entrepreneurial standpoint, I knew that I'd be able to start and scale something with fuck all money. Mm. And that was the big kind of drive as to why I wanted to get into tech, because I knew that I'd be able to build a business faster and cheaper than in any other sector. So I was toying around with a couple of different ideas, bouncing ideas off friends and colleagues and stuff. And I actually started working on a biometric payment company. So we built a prototype where you could link your fingerprint to your credit card. And you could just pay by touch. I thought this was a really cool concept, get away from these plastic cards. And it didn't work for a myriad of different reasons, but primarily that it was just going to be, it was too hard to get over at MasterCard and Visa and get into their networks. It's very, very complicated. And we couldn't get investors to kind of come in behind us on this. So we decided to shelve that idea. And over pints, while we were commiserating the shelving of that little project that we'd worked on for about 7 or 8 months, one of the guys I was working with at that time suggested, well, what about online grocery delivery? It's a massive pain in the ass. And my head of product will kill me because he's always giving out, but my
honest reaction was, that's a fucking shit idea.
Nobody makes money in grocery and it's not going to change the world.
Yeah.
And okay. that was how I honestly felt about it. Now, I knew nothing about the market at that stage, you know.
Had you guys sat down and said, right, let's come up with a new idea, or was this literally just...
So, it was... We were killing our first idea, which was Pay Me. So you can see we weren't very creative with names.
See where the branding is going from.
Yeah, we were not creative with names at all. So we were killing that idea, and over pints, we said, well, look, you know, we're interested in doing a startup. We've been working together for 6 or 7 months on this. Let's do something, you know. We're kind of already halfway there in terms of emotionally, we were already vested in starting a business. And so it was over pints that we just started kind of spitballing ideas. And this was the last idea of the night, and I went home to my missus and I said, like, you know, so and so suggested that we should do online grocery delivery, and I think it's a terrible idea. And she was like, well, do you know anything about the market? I said, no. She says, well, why did you start there?
And so pretty logical.
That was such an obvious next step. So I went off and I started doing a bit of deep diving into the market, the structure, the economics of it, the players, and I fell in love with just how awful the market was and just how unfit for purpose it really was, you know. When I first looked at online grocery in 2014, it was a £9 billion market, and it was losing £300 million a year as an aggregate. That was the combined losses of all the retailers estimated by, you know, some of the big retail agencies. And so when I looked at it, I was like, okay, so you've got a massive market. Like, £9 billion is incredibly large. Like, the residential electricity market in the UK is £13 billion. So nine is massive. And when I looked at grocery, all I saw was a commodity market. Something that everyone had to buy all the time, every week, forever. Massive, integral part of our society. But the distribution network for online grocery was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. You had nine separate distribution networks, all trying to do the same thing, all with their own independent vans, their own independent drivers, and all of them essentially cancelling each other out, preventing economies of scale, and just not able to do anything better the next day. Mm. And you know, the way we were looking at it, the consumer demand for online was going to double in a decade to £20 billion. Those losses were going to continue to compound. And the consumer...
I'll stop you on one thing. Sure. When you say distribution network, what does that mean?
So,
for someone not familiar with grocery.
So we had nine distribution networks. We had the Tesco network, the Sainsbury network, the Asda network, the Supervalue network. They're all individual logistics networks, all trying to do the same thing. But ultimately, you know, with limited volume and competitive pressures and poor infrastructure, massive CapEx costs, you know. And so that's the model, essentially. But any commodity... like gas and power being a perfect example. The only reason we have heat and power in our homes and businesses is because we share the infrastructure. Mm. We have one single gas network. We have one single electricity network. But for this one, we didn't. We took a completely odd approach with it. So for me, I thought that seemed like a really big opportunity.
It's very interesting, though, that your past experience suddenly allowed you to see... And people often get worried about that. Entrepreneurs often, or potential entrepreneurs, I should say, get worried, oh, I don't have no experience.
Yeah,
I've no experience in whatever, but often it's the best approach.
Absolutely,
completely fresh eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I often, like, I don't know if you can ever find a position where your past experience is not going to be applicable in one way, shape, or form. But forcing it into a very specific box of, oh well, I was an energy consultant, you know, and that's like the principles of my industry, you know, are underlying mostly financial in nature, and so, you know, and distribution in physical sense, but all of that stuff's applicable. I'd hazard a guess that most people, if they really thought about the macro industry or market that they operate in, not their micro role, but the macro of understanding their industry, that a lot of what they know is probably applicable to other industries too, some more than others.
Yeah. And how did you said you went off and researched, so what were your first steps? What got out the notepad and just...
So, like I said, market research was the first. So I just Googled everything. Everything. Like, there wasn't an online grocery article or a market review that I had not read. And that was the first step. I wanted to know who was in the space, how they were performing, why were they losing, what was the long-term macro trend for the market, and was anyone doing anything different, you know? And that was the first step, so finding out what was out there. The next step after that was, once I had a concept on what the what the business model or what the idea needed to look like. Then I got to the financials.
Okay.
So I started building a financial model to understand the cash flow. Like, how? What are the economics of this business as an individual entity? Mm. Now I understand the market numbers, but what's this business going to look like? What are the cost structures going to be?
So you took quite a methodical approach. You took a very studied approach to it.
Yeah. Yes. Now, remember, this is number five. Mm. I had four spectacular failures beforehand, where I wasn't methodical, wasn't diligent, didn't do the homework, and just kind of went in guns a-blazing. And I think I probably learned a huge amount from that process, because I definitely, when it came to buying me, it was incredibly deliberate. You know, even when I decided I wanted to get into this space, I decided, okay, well, this is going to be a platform company. You know, I had seen some companies over in the US doing something similar, which I really loved. I loved the approach that they were taking, and I thought, this is going to work really well in Europe.
Mm.
But I realized it was going to be a tech play platform company, and I had no background in technology or platforms at this stage, really.
Okay.
I didn't even know what a platform company was. What does that mean to be a platform? And so I actually quit my job in the energy markets, and I went to get a job with the biggest platform company I could find in Ireland, and I ended up in Salesforce. So I specifically went to Salesforce to do what I considered a master's in platform technology. And I spent a year to the week in Salesforce, that learning everything I could about platform technology, architecture, design, what it means to be a business like this.
So someone paid you to research your business?
Yes. I often said it was like going to an incredibly cool university and getting paid really well to go there.
That's next level thinking, though. I think a lot of us, I struggle to think beyond next week. To think that deeply and to go and study it that deeply takes a lot of patience.
Yes. And patience, it does take patience, because that's not an easy pivot and all the rest of it with it. But I knew that if I was going to make a real go of this, that I needed to prep and I needed to take my time. And also I needed to continue to watch the market and see how it was going and developing. And, you know, was my initial analysis correct, you know, and make a couple of assumptions and see how that plays out and see if there anything changes. In that time, I, you know, in the year that I was there with Salesforce, by pure coincidence, I got to work in the FMCG vertical. And that was just a nice little bonus where I got to work with the likes of Unilever, Coca-Cola, and learn about some of the nuance of the industry that I was hoping to get into. And during the year there, I was 9 to 5 Salesforce. You know, they paid for my time and they got every ounce of it during the working day. But 5 to midnight and weekends, it was all about buy me.
Love it.
I often find myself buried in spreadsheets every evening with a couple of bottles of wine.
It takes that commitment, though.
It does,
because that's hard. To go back into a salary job, I did something very similar. Go back into a salary job and to go from being an entrepreneur where you were the master of your destiny, and you go back in a 9 to 5, and I remember going back in, you get your little name badge, and I was like, Jesus Christ, what have I done? But it motivates you.
Yeah, I mean, fierce. Do you know what? It's funny. I have a couple of friends that have gone off and built really, really great businesses, and some of them are entrepreneurs for life, you know. I've never been like, you know, a militant entrepreneur. I quite like working for good, you know, great businesses. It's something, and I have to be excited about the product. I have to be excited about the market that I'm doing. And, you know, I spend anywhere I'm working or any market I'm in, I'm gonna learn a lot about it, and I'm gonna be very well read on the subject. Because I find that excites me, you know, to be an expert in my field. You know, so I have to be excited about it. But yeah, I have a lot of friends who would say, oh, I could never work for somebody else. I'm not that disinclined, you know. I think if I was to think now, having been out now 3 years on my own, and Buy Me is by far the most successful business I've worked on, do you know what I love the most is making my own calendar and being out of the office, meeting people. You know, I don't have to be anywhere at any given time. And, you know, the amount of incredible people I've met over the last 3 years has probably been one of the biggest value adds to starting a business that I've just met. My network has, I would say, not increased incredibly in size, but the quality it has definitely improved, because I've just been out there meeting really high quality people. And I think that's one of the rewards you get, one of the more intangible rewards you get from taking that risk and going out. Because that's something that, you know, regardless, win or lose, you walk away with all those contacts and those people.
Definitely. We chatted about it very, very briefly upstairs in terms of, that's why I'm doing the podcast.
Yeah, which I think is
to meet people like yourself.
Terrific ROI.
There's, like, honest to God.
Yeah.
Like, spending an hour or two with someone like yourself, you learn so much.
Big time. Yeah.
You know, you can sit behind the laptop all you want, but you only learn so much.
Yeah.
You only learn what's one side of the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just to listen to an entrepreneur's story is fantastic. Like, it's just, as you say, the ROI of this is huge. So how did you prototype then the idea? Stage two, how did you get from where you were? So you went back, you did the job for a year. You must have done a phenomenal amount of research in that.
Yes, so I shamelessly found anyone who was doing something similar in the US, and I replicated whatever worked. Ideas are a dime a dozen. Execution is everything. And so I didn't want to reinvent the wheel. I wanted to accelerate as fast as possible. And so I looked at what was working in other markets, and I replicated. Then there was a huge amount of nuance. Like the first version of our consumer app, what customers see when they download the App Store, that was replicated quite a lot from looking at other competitors around the world. But our back end personal shopper app, we built from scratch. And the only way we were able to build that was that when I quit my job in Salesforce and I went full time, I was the first personal shopper. And I did about 1,800 grocery deliveries over the course of 24 months. And
I love that.
And that was the only way to build the personal shopper app was to just do it, do the job. And so that was, there was a huge amount of work that went in there. But going back to your original question on the consumer side, during my stint in my master's in platform, I actually rounded up, we did a lot of customer survey. And that was one thing that I really wanted to do, because to get investors behind me, and especially in the early days, like, market data is very powerful. Like I said, ideas mean diddly squat when you're talking to people, because everyone has a nuanced opinion on whether your idea sounds good or not. The only thing you can push back to investors when they shit on you is great market data that validates your assumptions, you know, because otherwise they are just that, assumptions. So I actually, funny story. So the way we did it, wanted to do service, so I wanted to go somewhere where I was going to get lots of consumers, lots of like just standard people. I rang a shopping center in the Dublin area and asked them how I wanted to do, you know, it was a sexy, cool startup. You know, we wanted to do some market research. Would you mind if we came down and did a couple of surveys in your kind of court area, your forecourt area? And they're like, yeah, sure, absolutely. That's no problem. 1,800 a day.
Wow. Yeah. 1,800 euro to do a survey.
To do a survey.
Oh, wow.
I was like, holy shit. So I very
they thought you were like a professional marketing company, or they thought you were.
I don't think they cared. I think that was just their day rate.
Wow.
Whether you're a big business, whether you're a small business, you want to come in and do something in our space, it's 800 quid a day. There you go. Take it or leave it.
So back to the drawing board, standing outside in the street then?
Yeah, not quite. So
I can guess where this is going.
So I very politely said, that's no problem. Listen, let me go have a chat with our marketing department. We had no marketing department.
Yeah, well,
Let me go back and have a chat with them, and I'll come back to you. What was your name? Oh, Lorraine. Oh, listen, Lorraine, really appreciate it. Thanks so much. So that was on the Thursday. Saturday morning, myself, five of my colleagues from Salesforce wearing Buy Me uniforms and t-shirts, nice, rocked up to the shopping center and just started surveying. And so we were probably about a half an hour, 40 minutes in, when I was approached then by a security guard. He said, you're not allowed to be here, you're going to have to leave. I said, Lorraine in head office said it was fine to come down and do a survey. She said, it'd be okay. You can give her a ring if you want. Hoping to God
Lorraine is off on a Saturday,
that
hopefully
he wasn't going to bother Lorraine on a Saturday, you know, on the weekend. And sure enough, he didn't. We managed to get away. We got a whole day.
That's gutsy.
I think we got about 350 surveys done that day, which was the body of our market research.
Wow.
Very funny.
Sweat pouring off you. Here's talking to the earpiece. What's the worst going to happen, I guess?
What's the worst that can happen? You know, what are they going to do? They're going to have me arrested? No. They're going to tell me to sling my hook. And I sold electricity door to door during the university. I've been told to fuck off plenty of times. So that didn't bother me too much.
It's amazing all the experience you have, every bit of experience you get brings you to a point.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to draw on everything. You know, everything adds a bit more context, a bit more nuance to the way you're going to look at the world and the way you're going to approach each challenge. And, you know, I think I've tried to always take learnings from everything I've done, you know, whether it's selling electricity door to door or importing electric golf trolleys from China and selling them in pro shops around the country. Like, the most random of things, but yeah, all of it feeds in, and there's learnings and takeaways from everything that you can apply going forward.
And what was the most interesting thing that came out of that survey then? Where did that set you off in a certain way? Did something really valuable come out of that?
Yeah, so it validated that there was demand, for one, that, you know, customers would like same day grocery delivery, 1 hour grocery delivery, the on demand nature of it, you know, because there already was next day. You know,
this is 2016.
This would have been 2015. So this would have been, yeah, probably summer of 2015.
So the on-demand apps are starting to
bubble. Yeah, Deliveroo is doing pretty well.
Okay,
Deliveroo is probably a billion company at this stage. They've done they've probably reached unicorn. Uber's, you know, definitely has already changed the world to a certain extent.
So people were aware. They
very much so. Yeah, Halo was popular here. Yes, so there was definitely Just Eat was still. A lot of the education piece had been done. I would say that fast forward now 3 years and the market has continued to just compound in that direction. Yeah. But yeah, back then it was people were already starting to get clued in with the idea of on-demand convenience.
Mm.
So I'd say, yeah, that was one thing, proving that, okay, for groceries, there could be demand here. We got a sense that customers would pay a premium for it, which is very important because groceries is a very tight margin game. And so we needed to know that we would actually be able to put more margin into the supply chain if we created a really powerful customer experience, and that customers wouldn't mind paying a premium for that, because otherwise our unit economics wouldn't make sense and the business wouldn't work. So these were types of things that we were able to ask customers, you know, how much would you pay, or, you know, would you be comfortable with this price point at that price point? That was really, really important. And then the other, and this would be a top tip, if anyone's ever starting a business and they're doing a survey, get their name, email, address, and phone number at the end of every survey, because you build a leads database. And that was incredibly valuable for us when we decided to launch the product, because all of a sudden we had 400, 500 leads already in our system.
Salesman in you.
Yeah, that's 100%.
Pipeline, warm lead.
And then we'd be able to push the product out to that database of customers that were already primed to use it.
Mm.
And that would give us a little bit of a kickstart when we wanted to launch the product into the market. Because, you know, when you're trying to get a consumer-facing platform, a consumer-facing proposition in Ireland is incredibly difficult to not just launch, but to get funding for and build. And so you really need to create very strong numbers straight off the gate for this type of business. And so I think building up that little database of leads was incredibly valuable and paid off.
Were you in your day job still at this point?
Yes. Yeah. 100%. 9 to 5:30.
I think that's an interesting point, though, because so many people are like, oh, do I need to quit? Do I need to go all in? Sometimes you do, but oftentimes you don't. Like, so it's interesting. How did you balance the two?
I made sure I crushed it 9 to 5. Like, I really went in and I made sure I was a top performer. You know, it's easier to go about your own business when people know that you're going to come in and hit your targets. Yeah. You're going to come in and execute. So I think that was step number one. You know, I focused all my energy on my day job for my first 6 months. All my energy went into learning about the business that I was in and the role that I had and how to crush it. And then the following 6 months was all about, okay, I know that role now and I can execute, and now I'm going to start applying all my learnings into BuyMe and start working towards my exit.
Okay.
And, you know, that was kind of the way I wanted to approach it. You know, I didn't, like, also, you know, I think from a contingency standpoint, you know, if BuyMe didn't work out, you know, if I hit a barrier, like, and I could have hit a barrier at any time, maybe I did the market survey and every customer said, that's a shit idea, you know. Had I hit that, I wanted to still be able to build a successful career in technology.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I always try to kind of balance how I approach things. I don't believe that you have to go all in anything. You can take measured approaches to risk. And I think that was what I wanted to try and achieve in those earlier days.
I think all great entrepreneurs do, especially the ones like yourself, experience. You realize you get burned once.
Yes.
You probably get burned twice, maybe even a third time, and you're like, you need some money.
Yeah, well, like, that's,
you need
it
to live,
yeah,
as well.
100%. Like, I mean, I was 4 fails in, and I had to take a break. I had to take a break for like 2.5 years, roughly, like, just to recover, you know, emotionally, spiritually, and financially.
The Holy Trinity, you're dead right.
Yeah, because, right, you know, when you go through that process and that journey, I mean, it really, really takes it out of you. And to have gone through, you know, 3 or 4 in a row, I definitely need to take a breather. And so I became a company man for a while, and that didn't bother me at all. You know, I think I see massive benefits, and I take huge enjoyment out of being both an entrepreneur and an employee.
Mm.
You know, they're very different journeys, but no, I don't believe one is necessarily better than the other.
That's an interesting point,
so it's just different.
And how did you then, so what you're building, it sounds like an expensive business to build.
Tis. Consumer facing businesses are not cheap. Certainly not. Which kind of goes against my original idea of getting a business that I could scale, you know, cheap and cheerful.
It can scale, but it'll need money. So yeah. How did you go from, zero to where you are now?
Our funding process, and in fact, our entire launch was the most bizarre and incredible experience I've ever had, I think, and maybe ever will have. We built our prototype, did all our market survey, and got a basic version of the Buy Me platform up and running, finished our testing in late 2015, and then we were going to bring it to market in February 2016. Last two quarters of 2015, I raised €100,000 of pre-seed capital to do a 12-month pilot. So I knew that I could quit my job, I'd fucking take a 30 grand a year salary, and I could go for 12 months and just see if I could find product market fit. You know, I was willing to take the hit on salary and do that for a year and see if I could get to the next stage. For anyone who's interested, I suppose the funding process was new to me. Mm. You know, I'd raised a little bit of money, you know, 50 grand here to start a little businesses back in college and stuff, but I'd never really raised kind of much more than that. So I did 25,000 friends and family and fools, I think some people call them.
3Fs,
I've always had friends and family invested in any business that I've started. I'm a firm believer that if you're going to go and ask a stranger for money, it's going to help if they see that you're willing to have an awkward Christmas.
More tricky.
Yeah. Like, you know, if they see that you're willing to take your friends and family money and risk it on this idea, then you're probably pretty committed. So I always start there. Then I went to Enterprise Ireland and we got the CSF €50,000 competitive start fund grant, which gave us 75 grand.
Okay.
And then I went to an angel investor who I'd met throughout my previous journeys. He had just exited a business. And I said to him, look, I've got this great idea. Here's the business plan. Here's what we're going to do. Here's the validation and stuff. And I've already got 75,000. If you gave me 25, I'd have around 100, you know, and that would give me enough for 12 months. So he decided to back me, and that got us to the 100 mark. And we were able to bring it to market at that stage. Now, I was convinced that if I had a good product, good customer experience, decent KPIs, and I hit the goals, and I had, you know, maybe 600 to 700 customers, active customers on the platform, I'd be able to raise £1 million for this business. Surely I'd be able to raise £1 million within 12 months. It took me 2 years to raise 850.
Okay.
I completely misjudged the roadmap and the challenges that we were going to face during that process. And it was a mix of things. You know, when I look back now, Ireland is a terrible place to launch a consumer business. So that's one. You know, typically we're a very small market. You know, we don't have big sectors. So the only reason we were able to get this to where it is today is because grocery is such a high transactional volume market. It's an €11 billion market in Ireland alone. Okay. There's not many markets that are that size, you know. So the other side of it was that 5 weeks after we launched, I had one of the largest retailers in the country send me a cease and desist letter and threaten litigation. If I didn't shut my business down, they were going to take an injunction out against me.
And I've been there as well, yeah. So I was hoping you were going to bring this up.
That was unexpected.
Tell that story.
So 3 months before we launched, I wanted to have two types of retailers. I wanted to have a discounter and I wanted to have a branded retailer. Because I wanted to see how those two... this is all an experiment. I just wanted to see how those two retailers might perform in this new channel. Because that's what I felt I was building, that brand new channel within the grocery sector. So I went with the largest and I went with the smallest. The most obvious.
Yeah.
Just in terms of purely in market share. And 3 months before I launched, I actually got an introduction to a retailer. I won't name names, but I got an introduction to a retailer. And I went in and showed them the app. I showed them their store on the app. I had about 40% of their products, which I was able to get off the internet. And I was asking them to give me the other 60% of products, so I had I'd have a full basket for the customer, because I knew that would be important for my retention rates and all the rest. Mm-hmm. And if they were willing to do that, I'd share all the learnings, all the insights. You know, I'd take them online for free, and, you know, collaboration, knowledge sharing, etc.
Did they have a delivery option?
Nope.
Didn't. Okay.
No delivery option. So I got a very polite fuck off. You know, it was kind of like, yeah, it was like, it was, look, you know, sounds interesting, Devin, you know, looks nice. Keep doing what you're doing and out you go.
See you there.
And stay in touch.
That's always a good one.
Yeah, I don't think they took
infinitely me open to like, let's stay in touch.
Yeah, I don't
next
think
next Tuesday, good. I'll get back here next Tuesday.
I don't think they took me seriously at all. So all I heard was keep doing what you're doing.
Like a good entrepreneur.
Yeah, so I did exactly that.
So it's not a hard no then.
No, it was very friendly. Yeah. Like I said, very polite. Yeah. And so I went ahead in February 2016, launched it on the platform. And we took off. I mean, you know, we emailed all our, you know, leads. I reached out to a property management company and I said, look, we're a sexy new startup launching in Dublin. Wouldn't it be cool if all of your residents from all of your property developments had access to this personal grocery shopping before anybody else? We'll release it with you first. Mm. Would you mind, awfully, if we could, you know, put your logo on a letter with our logo and we'll put it in the letterboxes of all your apartments and houses?
That's a good idea.
You know, dear residents, you know, from the management company.
Yeah.
Sure, no problem. Didn't cost us a penny. They were happy to do it.
Brilliant.
And I think we leafleted maybe 1,800 homes in Dublin. And we got really...
With permission as well, which is nice.
Yeah, I always ask for permission. This is the trick. I always ask. Just
the answer is not always that important.
Yeah, always ask. It's really important, I think. And so I went ahead and we got, you know, great lift off from the very first. We had 1,800 downloads in the first 5 weeks. And remember, it was just me.
From a standing start.
From a standstill. And it was just me and one other guy basically doing the grocery delivery. So, like, you know, we would get like 40 or 50 orders all in into a 3-hour window. We had no fancy algorithms or, you know, Jarvis is our AI that we call it now, but we didn't have anything. We just had spreadsheets and product lists. And we would get orders from all different sides of the city. We'd be going from side to side as desperate as possible, trying to fulfill orders and making absolute balls of it in most cases, but learning a huge amount. And then 5 weeks in, I get a phone call from this retailer who I'd met previously, but from someone else this time, saying, hey, Devin, how's things? We see things are getting a lot of attention in the press. Things seem to be going very well for you. Would you be interested in coming in for a chat? I said, absolutely.
See, they're very, very good. Yeah. Or very, very bad.
Well, I was, you know, one of my biggest milestones was getting a retail partner, you know, because this business, I felt that we were building a solution for the retail market. And like, I would expect them to welcome us with open arms, that we're finally here to help them win in the online channel. So I put together a deck, loads of data, loads of insights. Like, we're a data science company. You know, most people think we're a delivery company, but we're actually a data science company. All we do is manage the data and the cash flow of the market. We don't own vans. We don't own refrigerators and pay electricity, none of that stuff. We just sit on top of the market and we manage it and we make it more efficient. So I went in and for about an hour or so, they just soaked me for information. Asked me every question under the sun. I was able to tell them how often, what percentage of the time a customer would go into their store and find, not be able to find at least one product that they're looking for. So on-shelf availability is a massive challenge. We could help you that real time to improve supply chain. I was able to tell them they needed a new store in Swords because too much of their volume was going through Santry and it wasn't efficient. I'm sure there was lots of customers in Swords that would appreciate a store in this area. Here's a heat map that shows where all the customers are based. You know, so really rich contextual data.
Sorry, not to interrupt. How are you collecting all that?
It's byproduct.
Right.
So what happens in the Buy Me platform, okay, two stakeholders connect, personal shopper and a customer. We connect them through our data infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
We allow the transaction of data and cash flow between those two stakeholders to get a job done, which is the delivery of groceries within a specific time. And every touch point throughout that entire process gets recorded and just spit out the other end.
So your app gathers everything.
Yeah.
Gathers just all naturally. Completed orders. Okay, just great. Naturally. So that spits it all out.
Yeah, it's like byproduct.
Okay,
you know, it just literally just gets collected as part of the nuance of allowing this transaction to occur. It's a natural effect.
So you had all that to hand. They were like, brilliant, Devin. Tell us more.
But this is the exciting part. Like, and this was, for me, the data that we were generating was incredibly nuanced and contextual. And so I'm incredibly open. The way I approach business is that I'm incredibly transparent, no matter what. I think it's very important to do it because it sets the right playing field to get something done. If you're holding your cards really close to your chest, most people just find that, oh, don't know if I can trust him. He's not really willing to share, you know. So as long as I'm not compromising the business in any way, I'm always going to be very open. And I've been very open with the retail industry from day dot. Because I felt like there was a huge amount of learning to be done by the industry to win in this new space. And the only way we were going to be able to move the market would be to share as much of our learnings as possible.
Okay.
So when I went in, I did that, you know. And at the end of that hour or so, I got a, well, listen, Devin, thanks so much for that. Really appreciate the insights. But actually, the reason we brought you in is that our legal team is very upset that you've been using our logo without our permission. So you're going to get a cease and desist letter in the morning. Thanks for coming in.
Wow. They brought you in to tell you that.
Poor form, you know. You should have known at the start of the meeting, you know.
That just hand it to you and let you...
That would have been more appropriate, you know. Wow. So, you know, I just said what any good founder should say, which is, I said, cease and desist for what? I said, brand infringement. I said, what brand infringement? Oh, well, you're using our logo. I said, that's not your logo. I said, I don't agree, you know. And they said, well, no, it's very clear, and that's the way it is. I said, well, I'll tell you what. There's obviously some commercial value here. Brought you online for free. All this interesting data, you can keep that. I'll have my legal team have a look at it. And I'll come back to you.
You went home to Google.
I had no legal
team. I did the exact same thing. I went home, what does this mean?
Yeah, zero legal team.
I know it's not good, but what does it exactly mean?
I had one by the time I got back to my car. I rang like one of my advisors. I said, this has just happened. He said, right, I'll make an intro. And he put me onto a firm who we started working with on it. So, long story short, I spent about 5 or 6 weeks trying to get to a commercial discussion. Get this legal stuff out of the way. This is illogical. You know, there's no value here for either party. And so I spent a good bit of time trying to just get to the table and have a commercial discussion. It essentially appeared that there was no decision makers really locally to look after this space. And so the modus operandi was going to be shoot first, ask questions later. You know, if we don't understand it, just kill it and let's move on. We'll still be a $1 billion
Despite
company.
The fact that you were driving a huge amount of business their way.
Yeah, huge to us. To them...
I get it, yeah. But, yeah.
Yeah, it's... It was just the big business at its finest, yeah. You know. So I kind of got to a stage where I was like, right, okay, well, I've raised this money, you know, I've committed to this journey, and I've made a few promises to people that I'm gonna put this money to good work. And, you know, responding to legal letters, €400 a pop, is not what I consider good use of funds.
It can quickly burn out a storm. Yeah. And you're not focusing on the business.
Within five weeks, we were $3,000 in the hole with legal letters,
yeah.
You know. And so at that time, I said, right, well, if the industry needs us to be a disruptor, then we'll take on that role and we'll make this market happen. So I went to one of the outlets of this retailer and I bought 3,000 products. Bought one of everything. Brought it back to the apartment, filled the bathtub with ice and water, put all the fresh fish and fresh meats into the bath. We bought a doggy tent and cut the sides out, installed LED lights into the doggy tent and borrowed a DSLR from our investor. And photographed every single product, digitized it, created a database, and and then photoshopped every brand and every logo off every product, because they were claiming that they own 90% of the products on their shelf as well, and that's brand infringement there. So my theory was, well, okay, let's see how important this brand really is, because our lawyer said, look, you could use the word, you know, you could use their name, no
right.
problem.
That's okay.
You're in the clear. You can't use the logo,
right?
But I was now at a point now where I wanted to prove something very different, because what their legal letters were saying was that their brand was driving all of our growth.
I get you.
And that's a problem, because I was telling investors that consumer demand was driving all of our growth. And if you go through legal disclosure when you're raising capital and an investor reads that line, they go, oh, actually, maybe this isn't your growth. Maybe you are piggybacking, you know, and all this
slight
stuff.
Slight seeded out.
Yeah, so at that point I said... Let's do something completely different, and let's see how important the branding really is. So I just launched them back up on the platform as German Discounter.
I remember reading this story
no brands,
a few
no
years
logos,
ago
yeah.
and I got such a laugh about it, because it was around the same time I was going through a similar problem, and I just thought it was brilliant. And you got coverage as well.
We got great coverage, yeah. It definitely turned a negative to a positive, because at that time investors were very hesitant to even look at us, because we were in a litigious type of discussion with what was supposed to be our partner. You know, trying to tell investors that retail is going to one day love this when they're threatening injunctions, it's a hard sell.
Were you ever tempted just to pull out of that retailer? You're tempted to just go over to a different one?
No, because I'd already pissed them off. and I didn't want to piss off the whole market.
Okay.
Like, yeah, very, just very pragmatic about it. Like,
keep going.
Yeah, like, look, yeah, let's just stick with this now at the moment, because I don't want everyone to be annoyed at me.
Okay.
Like, yeah, we've and, you know, follow through is important, I think, in these types of scenarios. And also, we were now building a new story, a story of disruption, which was incredibly gotcha. Important for us at that stage, because if there wasn't an obvious market for you, you better be creating one. Mm. And so we had to really kind of start to weave that perspective for the investor climate that we found ourselves in. Remember, this is pre Amazon Whole Foods acquisition. Mm. You know, grocery was scorched earth when it came to investment. No investor was very excited or interested in this space. So we had to kind of weave a very interesting story from the get go. And so all of that disruption in the marketplace caught the attention of you know, a very large FMCG corporate, a brand actually, one of the biggest, and they ended up actually coming in and backing us in a very serious way. And that changed, it was a catalyst event, I think, for us in terms of where we found ourselves and how we managed to then pull a seed round together.
Okay.
Bit of a long answer to your original question.
No, that was probably, that story is, it's fantastic. I love that story. I remember reading about it at the time, and it just gave me such a, I think all entrepreneurs have had a little moment like that. Yeah. It's at that moment whether it either sinks you or makes you.
Yeah.
I think that's the defining moment in a lot of people's careers. It either crushes you and you kind of give up and go, oh, well.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, I always considered myself quite naive going into business, but, you know, I think people, and maybe I definitely do, maybe this is other people, maybe other people can relate to this, but I always kind of assumed the way the market works is the way the market works, and the big guys have it figured out, and there's, you know, there's clear rules of engagement and all the rest that goes with it. But what I realized throughout this entire journey is that, you know, the market is whatever you decide to make it, really, and you have to drive the change, and you have to understand what it actually means. Because what they were trying to shut us down, but they had no right to really do what they were trying to do. Mm. And there was other ways for us to navigate the market. You know, it got to a point where there was really questionable actions being taken against us. And, you know, again, you know, trying not to focus on the negative, we may push through the positive, but it definitely wasn't the easiest of journeys to get started. Mm. But I think because we made it through those trials, you know, the story stands for itself, and investors really connect with it now. And I think today, now I look back and I think that was probably one of the most valuable processes that we could have gone through is actually being a disruptor.
Yeah.
You know, now we're not, I don't see ourselves as a disruptor, and we certainly don't take the same approach. We actually have corporate partners now, you know, so
yeah,
we're much more legitimate.
And, well, I think it shows you what you're made of as well.
I think so. I would like to think so. Yeah.
It kind of proves what you actually, you're willing to do for the brand and willing to do then for your partners when it comes to it.
If yeah.
You're willing to do that at the start.
Yeah, and I think we've always been very mission focused, and we're very committed to making this, to fixing this market. And it has not, like, not grocery is obviously a big, big sector. You know, you have lots of different, you have discount, you have convenience, you have hypermarkets, supermarkets, and all the rest. You know, we're focused specifically on this new channel, this on-demand channel, this online convenience channel. And we're very, very committed to helping the industry solve this problem, because we feel that if we can, it's going to be quite profound for the market as a whole. You know, you're changing the way people live their lives on a daily basis, and I think that's something that is incredibly exciting. You know, when I go back to the sitting in that pub saying it's not going to change the world, you know, now when customers write in to say, oh, this service is amazing, you know, my mum is at home and she can't actually leave the house, and I'm able to order groceries and deliver it, or these types of little stories, all of a sudden you feel like actually you're making a bit of an impact on people's lives. Like, grocery is something that everyone has to experience in one way or another, and it's quite nice that we're playing our own part.
So stepping back to year one, yourself and another guy were doing all the deliveries. Mm-hmm. How did you then scale that up? Like, who delivers the groceries then? When you guys were like, right, need more than the two of us.
Yeah.
What was your next step?
Good question. So we actually had three co-founders when we started the business. So the idea was, one of our co-founders was our technical and our developer, and he was based actually in Armenia. So we're a half Armenian company. Like, we have an office in our Yerevan. We have 7 staff.
Oh, wow.
They actually just came over. They spent the last week here with us.
Okay.
And they've just gone home. So we've quite a big team there, and we're growing really fast there. And so I had another co-founder who was working with me here. He was based in Ireland. I actually found myself at a real critical juncture where I was the only one on the ground here doing grocery deliveries, which meant I couldn't meet investors. I couldn't meet anyone because we were 9 till 10 Monday busy, to Sunday. Busy,
yeah.
At any time an order could come in. Now, we were only doing maybe a handful of orders a day, but at any time an order could come in and I would have to drop whatever I was doing. I could be at dinner with friends, I could be out, I could be getting a haircut. If an order came in, I had to stop what I was doing, I had to go and do that order straight away because I needed the KPIs to stay strong. So it's kind of a catch-22, right? You're working every day and every hour to keep the KPIs right, but you have no time to tell anyone about it.
In the business, not on the business. Yeah. That old cliche. Yeah.
So after a couple of weeks of this, I was like, this is not going to work at all. And I was actually in another retailer fulfilling an order, and this guy, kid approached me actually. He was a young lad. And I shouldn't say kid, he's a young guy, but he was so excited to see Buy Me. Like, he had heard about us. He was so excited to see us, and he ended up like helping me do an order and helped me out to the car with the bags, and then was like, I would love to work with Buy Me. How can I do that? And within 3 weeks, he was doing orders for me, and then I was able to go and meet with investors. He's actually works with us now. He's full time and is our head of communities.
That's a great story.
Yeah, it's really, really, really nice, actually. Very organic. You know, he's the only person in the business that's done more orders than me.
Wow.
he knows the job.
So did you hire all staff?
I just hired him. Yeah, so he just came to work for me. I just needed someone that was going to be able to cover the network while I went on and had meetings. So,
logistically, yeah. That must be a nightmare, though.
Yeah, it wasn't great, if I'm honest. Now, we built in a basic buffer, so we got... Yeah, within 3 or 4 months, we constantly iterated on the platform, and we were always trying to improve scalability.
Okay.
And after about 7 or 8 weeks of launch, we made some big moves and some big improvements. So we were able to get basic buffering in, so that, like, you know, we would not let in too many orders. We would only let in enough orders that we could handle with a little bit of room for more. You know, so we'd always show a little bit of growth, but we weren't going to overdo it, because if we let too many orders come in and we weren't able to handle it, our customer experience would drop off a cliff, retention KPI would drop off a cliff, and bad reviews would start pouring in by the truckload.
You guess my next question. Like, how did you... Because our business as well, when we started, we were just... And someone asked me that question the other day, how do you handle so many people coming in at one time? How did you know the timing? You did a lot yourself, but if people are going, let's say, from Santry to Ranelagh, traffic... queues,
yep.
Tills, parking.
Yeah, it was messy. it was very messy, and, you know, occasionally we'd be late for orders. One of the tricks I found was customer expectations. So from the moment you accept an order, constantly thinking about customer expectations. What is the customer's expectations here, and am I meeting them? If I'm going to be late, I would let that customer know as soon as possible. The minute I realized that I could be late, I would get in touch with the customer by phone and I would give them a heads up that I'm going to be late. 9 times out of 10, if you got in touch with the customer before they realized you were going to be late, to let them know that you might be a little bit delayed, 9 times out of 10, they had no problem with it whatsoever. It was the times where you didn't ring them and you just showed up 20 minutes late. They'd flip the lid. Grocery is a very personal thing. You know, people take real exception if there's missing items or damaged items or short-dated items or if you're just late. Their time and their food. You know, two most important things to people. And so I focused incredibly hard on customer expectations, as did the rest of the team. And that's kind of something that we've, I think, baked in into the scale out of the business, because we've scaled tremendously in the last year. And, you know, always trying to bear in mind, how are we managing expectations? And not just for customers, but also now for our shoppers. Because we see our shoppers as just another version of a customer. And we're constantly trying to help them manage their expectations, make sure that they're able to have a good experience when they're working with us.
So who are your shoppers? How do you find them?
It's a blend of people, really. Students, a lot of students, empty nesters, semi-skilled workers. You know, it's a really mixed demographic of people. And what I think about, like, even when I go back to when I was in university, like I used to work gigs. You know, I used to work part-time promotion work. I'd get a phone call, "Oh, are you free on Friday?" Yeah, I could work Friday, and I'd do, you know, couple of hours or whatever, and choose my own hours, choose my own shifts. So it's I think from a college environment, it's a really good fit. We would have a huge amount of students, I think, and they work around their own lifestyles with that.
And are they staff or are they contractors, or what way does that work?
Full contractors. So they're completely self independent. They will let us know a week in advance of when they're available to take orders and when they want to take orders, and then our algorithm will just send them orders based on that availability. And they're essentially out doing their own thing, use their own car, their own smartphone, and connect directly with customers.
Okay, and was that one of the things that allowed you to scale so fast?
Potentially, you could say, yeah. So I suppose, I mean, we initially started where it was, you know, you don't have any demand in the early days, so you only have supply. So you actually have to just get shoppers on the network, which means you're essentially giving people payment just to wait. There might not be any orders, but you're going to get paid, you know? And so we would do that in the very early days. And then as you start to build demand, you can start to match those two together. It's very much a market supply and demand approach.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So you were literally at the early days just having people there on the proviso. Were you not terrified?
Not really. You know, budgeted it, made sure that we could afford to do it. And we only had a small number of people in the early days, you know?
Yeah.
But of course, you know, you don't have a huge amount of volume both on both supply and demand. So, you know, shoppers cancel their shifts, which they often do.
Yeah.
I would just jump on and take the order, you know? So it's, there's a certain degree of unknowns in the earlier stages, but as you get to a better level of scale and there's more volume and there's more supply and more demand, you're able to then match those things in a slightly more effective way.
So as you came then to the end of year one, you had your 1 year plan and the money wasn't coming.
So I ran out of money in June 2017.
Okay. I was trying to gently lead up to that question. There's no nice way to ask.
Yeah.
So you started, just give us the timeline. You started when?
February 2016.
Okay. And a year, 3-4 months later.
Yeah. We really stretched our 12-month runway.
Yeah.
And the benefit was that we were doing sales. You know, we had revenue coming in. So that allowed us to extend runway. You know, what looked back, actually, when I looked back there, we had a founder who left. Suddenly he was off the payroll, and so we had more money, you know, and that allowed us to extend our runway again. Yeah. So even what felt like a really, really unfortunate negative at the time, when I look back now, actually gave us more time to figure things out. And when that large brand came in to back us, you know, it was June of 2017. You know, I'd sat in Starbucks in Slorgan, and I'd done the last payroll to our shoppers and the team, and I had, you know, 1,200 quid left in the account. So it was, and I needed money to buy groceries, so this was it. This was the end of the road for us. And I had already done I'd already secured an investment deal from this backer, but the funds hadn't arrived yet. I didn't know when they were going to arrive, if they were going to arrive, you know. So I sat there for the whole day, just drinking coffee, refreshing the bank account, waiting for the money to land. Because if the money didn't land, then the party was over.
So you were down to your final day, effectively, really.
Yeah, pretty much, which was quite interesting because you got to kind of, you know, after 14 months or whatever it was of work, you kind of, you're looking failure right in the eye.
Comes down to this.
Yeah, it was like, you know, greeting an old friend for me.
There we go again.
Yeah, I'd been there before, so I, you know, it wasn't, I think I was better prepared to deal with it. You know, my first business, I didn't deal with failure very well at all, but this time around I was quite matter of fact, I think. But sure enough, half four, 100 grand landed in the account and went back to work.
Off we go again.
Yeah.
It's funny, we've never met before in person, but I remember sitting in an office with the partner you're actually talking about, and he was raving about this guy he'd met. It's so funny, it's only you have to come back to me right now.
No way.
I met him, it's probably around that time, and he was like, oh, I met this really cool guy, such a cool idea, and he pulled up your thing and he showed me, and I was like, oh, that's mad. And it's funny how now,
that's incredible,
a couple of years later, Dublin's so small that, and it comes so back cool. around. That's, yeah,
absolutely.
I love that.
That is crazy, and it's such a village. You know, and like I said, one of the things I think for anyone starting a business out is, like, the way I always put it is that it's a 40-60 rule. The first 40% is your network, who's involved in your business, why they're involved in your business. That's the first 40% of succeeding. And then the 60% that comes after that is your KPIs, your metrics, your performance, your execution. But without the first 40%, without getting those warm introductions, without being able to show who's on your team and who's invested in you, if you can't show meaningful parts to that first 40%, it's very unlikely investors even want to see your numbers. You know, it doesn't matter how great your numbers are. They buy the first 40%. They buy your story and the people who are on board. And so I think Ireland's really great for that because we are such a small little network of people, and people are so willing to help each other out. Like, I've had so many people meet me for coffees, mentor me, you know, give me introductions to investors or advisors, or just point me in the right direction. Like, countless number of people have helped me. You know, I said, like, I think the road of starting a business is very challenging and has very little signage. And the only way to get to where you're going is to ask people for directions. It's, there's no other way to navigate it. And I feel that's, we've definitely done a really good job of doing that.
That can be very hard.
Yeah,
it is. Because often you feel like the imposter syndrome.
Yes.
Am I faking it here? If I ask the stupid question, is this guy going to think I'm a moron? You know, yeah. You're probably looking at these guys as potential partners as well. But I agree with you in terms of transparency. I'd be the same. I'd always try, give as much as possible, hope for the best, and be proved wrong.
Yeah.
If you're proved wrong, who cares? Move on.
Well, that's it. And I think a lot of people are afraid to talk about their idea. And I think there's a couple of reasons.
Yeah. It's the worst. Stealth mode, alpha mode.
Yeah.
Oh, we're building
fear
something.
Fear mode. I think a lot of the time it comes down to fear. Fear that you're going to fail. Fear that you'll tell the world that you're going to do something and then not do it.
Yeah.
And what will people think about you then? I think that's a big, big part of the reason why people hold their ideas in. They don't talk about it. And, you know, they might convince themselves it's proprietary and it's for, you know, confidentiality purposes. But really, I think underlying that is fear. You know, I think one of the things that going back to my ideas, I remember trying to ask designers to sign non-disclosure agreements for a website idea I had. Like, you know, yeah. Now I haven't signed, I don't think I've probably signed maybe 3 NDAs for Buy Me in the last 3 years.
Mm.
It means nothing.
Yeah.
You know, if you tell a stranger your idea and they go off and they execute it better than you can, they fucking deserved it.
Fair play. That's true. You said it at the start, you know, ideas are 10 a penny.
Yeah.
Execution. I had that conversation with someone last week. We could all have 10 people who have the same idea and 10 people executed completely differently. Completely. 9 might fail, 1 might be a billionaire.
Absolutely.
No difference in the idea. Did you ever, when you were, just skip back a little bit, then we'll skip forward.
Sure.
When you were doing your year out, did you ever have the fear of missing out, the FOMO of what'll happen if I don't launch this now?
Did I ever have the FOMO? Sometimes. You know, sometimes I'd be like, oh, you know, something's happened, or what does that mean for the idea, you know, for the concept? And but nothing, I felt that the market, nothing had changed drastically.
Mm.
You know, had I still been working on the idea when Amazon bought Whole Foods, I might have felt like I was missing a trick. Because I do feel like we were very uniquely positioned, you know, when that deal went across the line. Because it changed the world. Mm. The grocery world just took one big step back and one sharp inhale of breath. You know, because a lot of people don't really think about it this way, but I think it frames it quite well in the sense that, you know, the grocery market, the total grocery spend, Ireland, UK, is a 250 billion euro market. Okay? The biggest player is Tesco's. And they're worth 19 billion. That's their market cap.
Mm.
And now they're going head to head in the only growth channel for their sector against a $1 trillion gorilla. That's 4 times the size of the entire fucking marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even a competitive conversation, you know. Amazon could buy Tesco out of its Christmas budget, its Christmas party budget. Like, it's 19 billion is nothing to them. And when you really think about what that deal in the US meant, like, you could see the stock price of almost every major retailer in the UK drop a few points because the market felt that wave and that shock. And you know, we found ourselves in this position where we had been banging the drum saying the market was going to experience a change, you know, something was going to give. Amazon has a very big drum, and everyone heard that one. And we always kind of like to put it as that if Amazon is a tsunami for the retail industry, Buy Me is a surfboard. Our goal is to help traditional brick and mortar retailers compete in a new world. And it's a new world that's very quickly materializing.
As I was driving over here, Amazon was one of the biggest questions I had for you. Where do you sit in relation to them?
As a direct competitor, you know. Amazon is a fascinating business. I'm a massive fan. I really am a massive fan of what they do. Not just to think about how big they are, and just the sheer scale and the size that they have, but the way in which they've approached this market is really unique. You know, you have the CEO or ex-CEO of Walmart coming out a year ago, you know, complaining to say that Amazon has an unfair competitive advantage because it doesn't have to make profit from the products that it sells because it generates money from AWS. its cloud infrastructure and cloud architecture is one of its most profitable business units. And Amazon did an incredible job of diversifying in its earliest years, and to a point now where it doesn't have to make profit on anything it sells. It also has a completely different investor profile, which is, I think, a really, really underrated competitive advantage. Because if you think about it, like Tesco PLC, you know, your investor in Tesco PLC is not investing in Tesco's because it's a trailblazer and it's an experimenter and it's an innovation and visionary company. It's investing in Tesco because it's a stable stock. You know, that's your stable stock part of your portfolio. And Amazon's where you put your risk money. Mm. Now, you want to see them trying things. You want to see them innovating and failing. Tesco, just deliver a dividend and a profit. That's why I invest in you. I invest in Amazon because I want it to bring me the world.
Yeah.
You know, on a plate. And so Amazon's able to do things traditional PLCs can't do because investors don't punish them for it. Tesco PLC and other, you know, public traded businesses like that will get punished if they don't execute perfectly.
It's a very interesting analysis. It's very true, yeah.
And so that gives Amazon a massive competitive edge. And you notice it when you sit and you talk with, you know, traditional grocery companies. You can sense that it's not that for lack of innovative, you know, leaders in the businesses. It's not because they're not clever. It's because they're not incentivized. All they're incentivized is the next quarter.
Mm.
And Amazon thinks in decades.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think there's so much nuance to the Amazon discussion and the threat it has and the upper hand it has and all the rest that goes with it. I find it quite interesting. And I suppose our whole goal is to try and be on the other side of the coin. To say, well, actually, it doesn't have to be this way. There's a better way,
mm-hmm.
You know. If retail leverages shared infrastructures, because that's what Amazon has. It's scale and size, you know. Whereas if you look at the whole market as a combined entity, it dwarfs Amazon. And if you could just get them to coordinate, if you can get the market to coordinate, it will actually have a far better chance at competing.
So if you could click your fingers in the morning and do one thing in terms of bringing Buy Me to where it needs to be, what would that be? You know, you're saying shared infrastructure. Is it that everyone just comes on and uses the Buy Me platform? Or how do you think you'll compete against Amazon?
Not everyone. I think you're going to have... Like I said, it's a massive... It's a $3 trillion market in Europe just for grocery. There's probably going to be a handful of players. You know, I feel that there'll be a couple of dominant players around Europe. I think Buy Me has all of the potential to be one of those. How we do that will be through an incredible network of and great funding partners. You know, this, like I said, this is not a business you scale for cheap. It does cost to scale, especially when you're competing with the likes of Amazon.
Mm.
So you need the right funding partners. You need the right corporate partners, people who act like, you know, and like I said, not every corporate gets it straight away. You know, we certainly have seen every spectrum of corporation that we could potentially work with. Some have been visionary and some have been massive barriers to us. So I think finding the right corporate partners will be a big part of it. Who's the right fit culturally? You know, not just, oh, because they're big or they're small or they're in this space or they're in that space. It's, do they have a culture of wanting to change the way this market works and to give it an advantage against where it might be going?
Hmm.
So getting out there and talking to people is a big part of that. And so I try to do as much of that as possible. So yeah, I don't know if that really answers your question, really.
We'll jump back. Actually, it'll probably emerge as we go through the rest of the chat. We'll jump back to June 2016. You just got the second 100K to keep the lights on the next day. You could leave Starbucks, you could go home,
yes,
have a glass of wine, relax. The next day, what was your thought process? Had you a plan in place for, right, year two, let's kick off, and this is where we're going to go?
Yeah, so my plan hadn't changed. You know, my plan had been iterative. I'd always been just changing with the challenges that are very tactical. You know, as challenges arrived, I would try and just have to deal with those tactically. I think that's probably a big challenge with startups is that you know, you're going through these early stage tactical challenges in the start, but you slowly have to become strategic.
Mm.
Or maybe not so slowly, you know, cause there can be massive inflection points. And so we're still making that transition today. In fact, you know, to one of our company values is, you know, think tactically, but act strategically. And it's trying to, you know, balance those two. So I knew what I had to do. I needed to raise a seed round. That was what I needed to do. So to do that, I needed further validation that I was doing something that was going to be an impact to this industry. And the best way to do that is to get people who have a reputation in the market already.
Okay.
You know, find great leaders who can come and join you on this journey and stand on their shoulders. You know, let allow their brand to lend credibility to you. Okay. Because I had no track record in startups or in grocery. So they were two things that I needed to solve.
Okay. For people who have no concept of what a seed round is, what does that involve?
So a seed round in Ireland is typically anywhere between $500,000 to $1.5 million.
Okay.
That could be a seed round. And that is essentially capital that you raise to prove out your business model. And that's it. Not profitability or anything like that. You want to be able to prove out your business model and show a path towards profitability. By the end of your runway of your seed round, by the end of the time your money of your seed round runs out, you should have identified a clear, scalable business model. And that's the goal of a seed round. So it's high-risk capital, early stage, that you raise to go out and try and find how this model is going to work. Because what the 100 grand beforehand was for was for validation, just to validate that there was product market fit for this concept, this idea. So yeah, so I knew I needed to go out and raise that. And so, again, introductions were a big part of that. I've got a great, actually, our chairman, Eamon Quinn, from the Superquinn family.
Oh.
I went to Futurescope, which is a conference in the convention center every year, all about the kind of future of industry. And I didn't have any network of investors at this stage. I didn't know anybody. And so I was there with a good friend of mine, a guy called Richie Donlan from Irish Startup TV.
I've seen him on LinkedIn and stuff.
He's terrific. So I was there with him and he was shooting the event. And you know, I was saying to him, I was like, I need to try and meet investors. And you know, here's what I'm going to do. And so he sees Eamon across the thing. And Eamon was obviously in Dragon's Den. And so everyone kind of knows the Quinn family from grocery and all the rest. So he goes, he'd be perfect. And I was like, oh, he's like, come on, I'll introduce you. I was like, do you know him? He's like, no, but he won't know that. And we went up and Richie goes, Eamon, how are you keeping? Listen, I just wanted to introduce you to Devin here. He's doing something that's right up your alley. I can't stick around, but I'll be back in a minute. I'll let Devin take it from here. And he goes
off. That's superb. That's like something from Sneaky Pete or
It was very clever.
Confidence trickster.
Yeah, very clever. Very clever. And Eamon's incredibly polite, so...
need that.
Yeah, it worked really well, yeah. And so Eamon heard my quick elevator pitch. And I don't like to bend people's ears. I think a mistake a lot of people make in the early days is that if they catch someone of their own, they'll pitch. And to a point where you kind of alienate the person because they feel a bit trapped. Yeah. And so what I typically got, and this was learned because I did this. I trapped people and
you're so excited though.
Yeah,
a lot of people are so excited about their idea they just can't chill the fuck
yeah
off.
Exactly. So what I got to the point where is that I would give my spiel, and then I would say, look, I don't want to take up too much time today, but I'd love to buy you a coffee and hear your thoughts after you've had a chance to think. And so he said,
gives them an out as well.
Which?
Gives them an out.
Exactly, give them an opportunity to exit the conversation.
Yeah, love to get a coffee. Now puts the ball back in their court.
Exactly.
I think I was reading something from Tim Ferriss or something about how he pitches people for his podcast. He writes it in a very specific way, has the ask, and then gives them the out at the end.
Right,
okay. Too busy right now. You know, we can circle back in 2-3 months and do it then.
Very. Did you do that with me?
Yes, I did.
I did exactly that.
Excellent.
Tim Ferriss podcast template email.
It. Very good, yeah.
But there is nothing worse, and you've nailed it there. Like, you're at an event and someone is just pitching you and pitching you and pitching you. And sometimes you'll be absolutely no fucking use to them.
Yeah.
But they'll keep pitching you and you're like, I do nothing in this industry.
Yeah.
Like, I'm literally nobody.
And also, I think it also adds a bit of desperation.
It's,
you know, and I think that's
very
obvious
as well.
Yeah.
It's very obvious after a while when you go to some of these events and you're like, oh God, I don't want to talk to that guy.
Yeah.
It's just, especially, you can imagine being a high net worth individual or someone of influence like Eamon Quinn.
Pitched all the time.
You're just like, oh Jesus Christ. He's probably started avoiding it.
No, absolutely. But so he was super polite and he said, yeah, look, absolutely. Happy to grab a coffee, drop me a LinkedIn message. You know?
Yeah,
and I was like, oh yeah, okay, I'll drop you a LinkedIn message.
Marcus spam.
Yeah, sure enough though, he came back to me within an hour the next day and we had a diary meeting and I went and just had a coffee with him. And then I had another coffee, and another coffee, and another coffee. And I was always pitching him.
Yeah.
But I was asking for advice.
Yeah.
It was never a hard pitch.
Yeah.
Until I got to a point where I said, you know, I'd really love to have you as a board member and someone who could come in and be a leader of this business. I think it's super relevant. I'd managed to learn enough about his own background and his interests in the industry that it was a clear fit.
Mm.
So I just needed to work out what did I need to have for him to feel confident enough to come in. And what he needed was another large investor.
Okay.
He didn't want to be the only, you know, pocket at the table. You know, he wanted to have another large investor that we could come together and start to build a real network and a real leadership team.
Everyone wants social proof.
Naturally. And so I was introduced then through another, actually I got an introduction to a guy who then introduced me to another guy. And that other guy happened to be a guy called Scott Weaver's Right, who's the ex-CEO for Morrisons.com.
Okay.
So his company was a company called Kitty Care, which he was actually one of the largest e-commerce platforms in Europe at one stage, and scaled it from a family business up to this incredible e-commerce business. And it essentially was a baby e-commerce platform. So it was like head-to-head with Mothercare. In fact, it was probably Mothercare's biggest challenger in the space. And Morrisons actually acquired that business for a very, very tidy sum in 2013. And Scott went in there for a couple of years to help bring them online. So again, super relevant. Knew how to scale, build, and sell e-commerce platforms. And he came in and joined us as our second investor and board member with his co-founder, Fred. And all of a sudden, I had an incredibly valuable team. You know, I was able to sit and tell people that my board has built and sold over €500 million worth of grocery and e-commerce businesses.
And when you say board, how did you go from just yourself sitting in the office, one or two lads, to then having a board of that caliber? They've seen it, done it, you know. How do you not going to go, oh Jesus? Like, what was your thought process about, obviously you were super confident and buy me.
Yeah.
But how did you, your first board meeting or your first, how did you set that up? Like, how did you go about?
It wasn't that hard because I'd spent nearly a year getting to know these guys before they officially joined.
Okay.
It was, like I said, it took me 2 years. I met these guys probably a year in after we had one large backer come behind us. And so I spent another year building this round out. So I got to spend a huge amount of time with these gentlemen beforehand, all the way to the point where we actually did a crowdfunding round as part of our seed round. And they came and joined the video before they were even investors. You know, they were part of telling the story of what we were and who we were and what we were trying to do. And we were able to have a very successful crowdfunding round off the back of that. And it was great to have them involved. But by the time the first board meeting came around, we all knew each other.
It was just another
It was naturally. Very natural. Very organic.
Yeah, okay, interesting. It's often hard to imagine how companies go from 2-3 founders and some employees to a board.
Yeah,
Often that leap.
I think most of the time it's super organic. Mm. You know, you're really just, you're meeting people who are mutually excited about what you're excited on. And you end up getting a room and start talking, and then you start putting a bit of structure around it, and okay, now we'll have an agenda, and here's the things that we should talk about every month, and you know, it just goes from there.
So take us on from June 2016, that say next year, what happened then? You got the extra 100K that was used to seed round. What was happening in the business behind that? So obviously you were now a step away from the business, really, were you? You were kind of...
No, not really. At that stage,
were you focusing more on the big picture stuff?
Yeah, so we closed our seed round in December 2017.
Okay.
And by that time, we were actually already in talks for our first corporate retail partnership. And so we closed our round. I think we signed our first contract in Q2. And then we went into kind of integration, technical development process for, you know, 3 to 4 months.
Okay.
And then we launched that retailer on the platform in Q1 of last year. Q3 of last year.
And up to that point, you've still been kind of like making it up, not making it up as you go along, but you've just literally been, you've just literally been putting stuff on yourselves.
Yeah. So, and I suppose the first big move, I think, was when we closed our seed round, all of a sudden we had a bit of money. You know, we had about 750 grand, 850 grand of capital ready to be deployed. Which was incredibly exciting. It was still just me and Shane, you know, the guy who joined me in the early days. On the ground here, we had a smaller team than in Armenia doing our development and tech support. But I knew we needed to make a very serious hire. I had a great board, but I needed some help on the ground. And we ended up just hitting the jackpot. So I the first hire I knew we needed to make was a product manager. Because we had three products. We have the Buy Me platform, and then we have our apps.
So there's three assets there that need to be optimized, and we want better retention and better conversion. So I knew that great product strategy and great product development was going to be key for our success. And I had been kind of playing that product manager role, having had zero product management experience in my career to date. I was kind of doing it. I knew I was doing a piss poor job of it. And so I knew that was probably going to be an important hire. Went out, I interviewed probably 8 or 9 people. It's funny, I actually got this really incredibly impressive executive. He was the ex-product director of product for one of the largest tech companies in San Francisco, or startups that, you know, not kind of super well established, but a really successful startup that raised a huge amount of money over there. And he had just moved back to Ireland. And I was trying to get him in the door, and he was going to be incredibly expensive, significantly more expensive than I really could afford. But I felt like having great people was going to be really important to success. And I ended up going to a point where I made him an offer, and then Amazon swooped in and offered him like $350,000. I was like,
wow,
cannot compete with that, you know? Like, wow. That was my first experience of like being just totally outmatched and outgunned in terms of trying to recruit great people. Like, that was my first taste of it, and it was a whopper. Like, this guy was a rock star.
Yeah,
you know. But I'm super glad that happened, because we ended up finding someone that was way better fit for the business. So I continued interviewing, and then next thing I met this guy called Kevin Hughes, who's our head of product now. He's with us over a little over a year, and Kevin was employee number 3 for Airbnb Europe. You know, so he joined them, he worked in eBay in his past lives, and, you know, came and joined Air. He was Airbed and Breakfast when he joined it.
That early?
Yeah, and they had just done a Series A, and they'd set up an office in Ireland, and when he arrived, like, the day one was building IKEA furniture, you know, and, like, so it was, like, super early stage, and he was with them from 3 employees to 500 over 4 years. So he experienced that entire scale-up. He saw exactly what that process was like. It was going from a small team to a big team. And it was a multi-sided platform.
Okay, you know, so you just like just hiring a person for a product, you're hiring someone who'd gone through the exact journey you were just starting.
Exactly, you know, all of that stuff matters. Not just that he understood the mechanics of a multi-sided platform, but that he had gone through that whole scale-up process. That, you know, he would have that understanding of the challenges that you're going to face. Because that's the stuff that makes you succeed. It's the execution, and for him to have gone through that before was going to be incredibly valuable for us.
How did you find him? I think that's
a recruitment. I used a recruitment with. Company, a company called Connexus, they put an ad up on LinkedIn, and they did a little bit of recruitment for us, and they sourced them, and then we sat down. Our first interview ended up in 2.5 hours long, and we just got on really well. He got it immediately. We got on very well. Yeah, it was a really really good fit from the day. I was smitten. Like, in interview one, I was like, I want to hire this guy.
You're lucky. Hiring is just one of those things that's so tough.
No, it's incredibly tough, and we've really had lots of challenges along the way. Like, we're now a team of 14. Okay. Yeah, we've gone from 3 to 14 in 6 months full time, and so we've definitely experienced what it's like to challenge. But we really really looked out with Kevin and a number of other incredible hires we've made in the last 6 months. Like, our team is probably one of my favorite parts about this business, and I often say that, like, Buyme is almost like a patchwork quilt. You know, I could sit down and I could tell you what each patch and each person on our team means and why they're stitched in.
Okay,
you know, they all have relevance. Mm-hmm. You know, our GM was employee number 60 for Deliveroo. You know, he scaled Deliveroo across 40 cities in the UK. Our operations associate, Jordan, was a migration specialist for Halo and My Taxi when they were merging. So he was working with the drivers to merge them onto a new platform, teaching them how to use.
Okay.
Incredibly relevant to us. You know, Shane, who's our community manager, he worked in grocery retail for 7-8 years in store, so he knows what the in-store environment looks like. It's just every single person on the team has a relevance, whether it be board or whether it be operation. Everyone has relevant experience, and everything that they, well, whatever industry they were in before, the goal is to identify what value that's going to bring, and then allow them to use it.
It's a crazy journey.
It's incredible. Yeah.
So where are you guys now? So your seed round was last year? 2017,
yeah.
Start 2018, was it?
Yeah. And we've just raised a few quid there recently as well. Obviously, our launch with Lidl towards the start of this year
was one of the bigger news pieces for us, and I think the grocery industry in general. We had articles in China and Russia and Netherlands. It was really picked up really well, and so we're kind of having a very exciting period of growth at the moment. So we've just raised a little bit of money to support that growth, and then this year, you know, I think, you know, we're gearing up for something quite special. Hopefully, it's gonna be quite an exciting one, I think.
That's such a good teaser.
Yeah.
I'll have to do a second one.
Yeah, there's a few things kind of coming down the pipe, hopefully. You know, and I think a lot of people kind of, and it kind of comes back to this kind of where we started, which is the concept of like, oh, 3 years in, you know, it still very much feels like a startup, you know, and there's still lots of challenges. And, you know, when you're in this environment, like when you're a startup and you're in that period of fast growth, it's a very delicate environment. And you have to be, you have to pay really close attention, because it's very easy to assume success. And the minute you start assuming success, you stop looking for failure, and it'll come right up and sneak up behind you. So I think
that's interesting. So you still have that fear, even though you're 3 years established now, you've raised effectively millions. It's interesting to hear you still have that clawing fear.
Yeah. This comes down to kind of maybe a thesis, I suppose. But, you know, I have friends who will never talk about failure. The only option is success, and that you should think like that. I'm not inclined to agree.
No.
I constantly look for where failure is waiting for us, because then if I'm looking at it, I'll see it, and I can deal with it. You know, and like I said, this market is moving incredibly quickly.
Mm.
Things are happening. Like Amazon just invested €500 million into Deliveroo this week. That's impactful. What does that mean for the market? You know, that's a
I was going to ask you about that. Like, it literally happened this week, so it's kind of perfect timing for this.
Sure.
What does that mean?
Well, if you think about it, it's €500 million worth of investment in the Grab for share of stomach. You know, and so essentially what you have is the FMCG market, the fast-moving consumer goods market and grocery, is resegmenting in quite a profound way. You have typically grocers controlled almost 90% of stomach. In back in the day, but now Deliveroo has made it so easy to get a really high quality restaurant meal delivered to your door. You know, how often are people ordering takeaway a week? Significantly more than they used to, I would say, because it's just so easy to do it. You have great companies like Gusto, you know, Mealbox Kits, Drop Chef, where they'll send food to you every week in pre-arranged boxes, chilled boxes. They'll send that to you. You're not hitting a grocery store anymore for that. You know, so there's these entirely new segments that are starting to emerge, and that's ultimately diminishing share of stomach for the grocery industry. So when I see €500 million investment from Amazon and Deliveroo, I just see €500 million investment into shifting the consumer away from grocery and into convenience restaurant delivery meals. So I think that's kind of important to think about, and it's certainly something when I, you know, find myself sitting in front of, you know, seasoned industry leaders in the grocery space. These are the types of conversations that I want to try and have with them. You know, what are they like? And again, I'm in this market 3 years. They have far more experience and understanding of the market than I do. And so when I get a chance to sit with them, I want to be able to ask these questions. Like, what do you think this means for your market? You know, so that I can start to understand the way they view the world a little bit. What's their perspective? And then try and present by me and present the opportunity in a way that's going to translate for them. And it's going to add value to their challenges, because that's what it's all about.
But surely investments like that only enhance your own status. They only enhance your model and your thesis of this. The last mile is so important.
Yeah, I think they're great indicators. You know, like again, if you think about it from an economic standpoint, you're always looking for market indicators. Amazon buying Whole Foods was a massive indicator that grocery was going to experience a significant shift. Unilever buying Dollar Shave Club.
Yeah,
$1 billion to go direct to consumer and circumnavigate the retailer. That to me is a massive market indicator that FMCG brands were no longer going to rely solely on retail to be their channel to customer. They were going to start to invest disproportionately in supply chain innovation. So these are all indicators, and just like that Amazon delivery deal is another indicator. You know, it's not going to have an impact tomorrow. But it is a huge amount of capital that's being deployed now, and it's directly into the space that I'm working in. So I can't help but have I love having conversations and hearing what people's thoughts are on it, to see what they think it might mean for their business and for their sector.
And in terms of platform apps, there's been a couple of IPOs in the last couple of weeks. I was kind of keen to ask you about that as well, in terms of Lyft, Uber, massively loss-making companies, but IPOing with huge valuations.
Yeah. So I think it's very easy to shit on these companies, and I think there's a lot of nuance that's probably been missed to a certain extent. I think tech companies are going public far too late. I think this is one part of it.
Interesting. Too late.
Too late.
Okay.
So all of the value is being sucked up by the private investor market, and then they're exiting at very late stages, having raised loads of capital and driven the valuation up significantly higher. Had Uber gone public when it was worth $30 billion, there would have been potentially $50 billion worth of valuation and growth that it could have experienced potentially in the public markets. So I think for one tech company is going public so late, I think that's one challenge. And it's one behavior change that we haven't seen before. Like, you know, the private companies being so large and so private for so long is very unique. We've not seen that before in the markets. So I think that's one aspect. The other side of it is that we are no longer living in a linear environment. Human intuition is linear by nature. We evolved chasing deer linearly across a field. You know, our entire perspective of time and space is all based on linear understanding. The world around us, our economy and industry, is now being transformed exponentially. Technology is becoming cheaper at an exponential rate. Our connectivity is changing the way we interact with one another at an exponential rate. You think about how much has changed from a technological and lifestyle standpoint in just 20 years. A fucking huge amount. And I think the biggest challenge we have is that we become very accustomed to the technology we have. I still find it so bizarre that people aren't freaking out that we are all super geniuses. We all walk around with little tablets that connect us to every single piece of information that's ever been created. Ever been created. You want to learn how to do open heart surgery? YouTube it. You'll find a video, and if you study enough, you'll learn how to do open heart surgery. Like, the fact that you just have this ungodly access to knowledge and information, I find is bizarre. But as a society, we become super adapted to it. And it's like, oh, it's just part of life now.
Yeah.
And that to me is that rate of change is happening so fast that we can barely even comprehend it. So we just accept it really quickly, because if we were to really think about it, our tiny little minds would be blown.
You'd sit there all day paralyzed.
Yeah, exactly.
By just the analysis of the choice paradox.
So
well.
To get back to the point of what that means, is I think these companies are investing on an exponential technology curve. So I don't think it's unreasonable to say that. I would say the vast majority of Uber's valuation today is built into the expectation of autonomous driving. That is probably where the majority of their valuation sits. You know, Uber has significantly more revenue, okay, loss making, but significantly more revenue than Facebook or Amazon did when they went public. Significantly more. And if autonomous car really does land, that technology really does land, and I think there's a lot of evidence to say it will, they will be galactically profitable overnight. And they have all of the infrastructure, all of the data networks to run those programs. But then again, market changes very quickly, and you have Tesla announcing that it's going to launch 1 million robo taxis that'll be fixed to the Tesla network next year into American
ambitious,
cities.
To be fair,
it also sounds like a possible Uber killer.
Yeah,
because Uber doesn't own that technology. They don't own autonomous. They've been trying to get into that space for a long time, but they don't own any significant tech in this space. So I think there's a few challenges that could emerge there. But nonetheless, they're in a position where they have enough visibility, enough scale, and enough access to growth capital to figure it out.
Would you buy Uber stock?
Would I buy Uber stock? Probably not.
So you're bullish, but
I'd
not.
I'd probably buy Lyft.
Lyft. Okay.
I feel a lot of the value for Uber has already been taken, you know?
Okay.
And not that they won't be a successful company. I'm actually very bullish on Uber. I think they will be a successful business, but I think it's probably going to be rocky for them for another 36 months or so while they kind of find their groove in the public markets. You know, not only do you have a business that of the scale that we've never seen in the public markets, but we don't know how the public market is going to react to that. But you also have a team that's now dealing with a very different environment, a global team that's not been a public company before. And so now all of the responsibilities and regulations that are going to come with that are going to be there's going to be teething issues. Yeah, I think Lyft probably has a little bit more value for the public markets now.
I also see a massive opportunity for consolidation between those two companies in the not too distant future. But yeah, whether the regulators will allow that to happen for anti-competitive reasons, I don't know. But yeah, it's very interesting though.
We're definitely going to have to do an episode 2 of this. I just realised what time it is, so we'll wrap it up quickly. I just want to ask you a couple more questions.
Sure.
For Buy Me Now, where are you guys currently?
We are at an inflection point. You know, we're in a very real way having quite an impact on our market, which I'm incredibly excited and proud to be a part of. We are growing very quickly. We're trying to find great people, you know, both here in Ireland and abroad. And I think we're probably, the next 18 months for Buy Me is going to be quite transformative. You know, we're going to go from small business, and if we execute right, I think we could be an incredibly large business.
We'll wrap up in a quick fire round. Very short, two okay. questions. If you weren't doing Buy Me, what would you be doing?
If I wasn't doing Buy Me, what would I be doing? I'd probably be doing another startup, I think. I think I'm at that time in my life now where I'm really excited to be where I am, doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very excitable as a person. I've fallen in love with just how bad this market is and how much opportunity there is for it. But, you know, I could very easily fall in love with another market and find myself deeply obsessed with its problems. So I'd say I'd probably be doing what I'm doing, maybe just in a different sector.
A lot of people listening to this podcast are potential entrepreneurs. They're people who have ambitions to be entrepreneurs. What would you be advising them to look at in the next, say, 12 to 24 months? What do you think there's opportunities in?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think about anything but grocery these days. So don't do consumer if you're in Ireland.
Okay.
I'd say that's probably one top tip, because that is really going to be a challenging space unless you're in an enormous market.
Is that gulf getting wider? Is it getting harder to start?
It's always going to be hard to draw. So the natural dynamics of the Irish market are going to always make it difficult to scale a consumer-facing business in Ireland. One, because most sectors are too small to get meaningful traction. We have 4 VCs in Ireland, and they all invest in the same stuff. SaaS, MedTech being the primary categories. So if you want to start a SaaS business or a MedTech business in Ireland,
okay,
great spaces to be in. We have a great investor network for those types of sectors. But when it comes to consumer, we don't. So that's part and parcel of it. But in terms of giving any specific industries, I don't really know. I haven't spent any time thinking about anything else other than this business for the last 4 or 5 years.
You're bullish on the on-demand model, though. You're bullish on the Ubers, the Lyfts, the deliveries.
Given the right circumstances. Yeah. A lot of people make the mistake of painting every on-demand business with the same brush. When in fact, the unit economics of each platform are vastly different.
Mm.
Basket sizes, average order sizes, demand curves within the day. You know, if you think about it, like Deliveroo is a massive challenge on its hands when it comes to on-demand. It has the Batman problem, is what we call it. So you have a flat morning.
The Batman problem.
The Batman problem. So if you were to draw it on a piece of paper, it's a flat morning, it spikes at lunch, flat in the middle, spikes at dinner. So you get these two bat ears. And those dead zones on either side of those spikes is incredibly challenging for a decentralized labor network, which is essentially what Deliveroo is. You know, so demand curves are very different. Grocery has a bell curve, and like electricity, actually. So it's completely unique by itself. Uber ride-hailing has its own demand curve, own unit economics. So there's lots of different nuances that come with these types of businesses. But in general, I am very bullish because the consumer demand for convenience is all-powerful at the moment. And I can't see consumers changing their mind about having things convenient. Okay. In fact, our entire society is built around making things as easy as possible. So I have a feeling that's probably why this market has found itself where it is today.
Okay.
It's pure consumer need.
I think you've given your answer there. And then what book would you recommend? So every episode we do a giveaway. So whatever book you recommend, we'll give away. People just need to share this post on social media and just tag us. So what book has kind of helped your entrepreneur journey?
Oh, that's a really good question. And I know the name of it and I've forgotten the author of it.
The name is fine. We can.
So the very best book I've probably read, and this is specifically for anyone who wants to build a platform or a multi-sided platform of any way, shape or size, is Modern Monopolies.
Modern Monopolies.
How to Dominate in the 21st Century.
Okay.
That was an incredible book. And the reason I loved it was because it gave all of the case studies and the background of why certain platforms dominated.
You know, what was different about Facebook, whereas before it came Friendster and MySpace?
Yeah.
What happened? Bebo. You know, these were dominating platforms. Why did Facebook crush it? What did they do different? I'm not going to spoil it for you. It was all about the execution. It was all about execution.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, it wasn't about the idea. Why did Nokia miss the curve on smartphones? Yeah. They were a dominator.
BlackBerry, same
yeah,
way.
Incredible. Yeah. Like I love commercial history. And this book was written by the CEO of Applico, one of the largest app platform development companies in the United States. He's also an economist enthusiast. His father is a very well-recognized economist. And he writes this book with a very economist mind frame. So it's very macro,
okay.
Which I quite liked, because I think a lot of people can get very nuanced, very micro into specific industries, where if you try and stay back as far as possible, you can get a bigger picture. And you start to understand why the world works the way that it does. I really enjoyed that book. And that would be one that I would highly recommend to anyone interested in platform development.
Great. And history always repeats. We always keep looking for new trends.
So they say, yes. It'll be interesting to see what the next 10 or 15 years have in store for us. But to be honest, I'm incredibly excited. Not just to be in this sector. I feel like it's like the last great frontier. But I think we're in for a just truly wild ride in the next 10 or 15 years across every sector.
Where can people follow that? Where can they follow you and buy me? So give us kind of the
thank
place
you for the
plug.
So they can find us on Facebook. If they're interested in buying me, they can download the app from Android and iOS, and they can place an order. If they use the voucher code buy me, they'll get free delivery on their first order.
Brilliant.
And they can find me on LinkedIn, Devin Hughes. Fairly easy to find. They can find me on Instagram as well. I do have a private account, but if they ask, I'll be more than likely to connect with them. So yeah, that's probably the best way to get us.
Devin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Pleasure.
Really appreciate it. Pleasure.
And that's a wrap on episode 13 of The Entrepreneur Experiment. What a chat with Devin. A fascinating guy. I could have spoke to him for absolutely hours. We'll be getting him back on the podcast again. For those of you that made it the whole way, thank you very much. You're in with a chance of winning Modern Monopolies. Simply share this podcast on social media and tag us. I'll see you next week, Thursday at 6 a.m. for episode 14. See you then.